Yeah, I'm talking to Jack Johnson.
Yes.
Jack, tell me a little bit about yourself first. Where did you grow up?
Well, I grew up here on this farm. So I've lived all my life here in County Tyrone, in the townland of Rattore, beside Clogher. I went to school in Oma to the local academy, and then I went to Trinity College, where I took my degree in history. I taught for the first 16 years of my working life, a year in Dublin, and then the remainder in the local high school at Five Mile Town, where eventually I became head of the history department. But I gave up history teaching in 1985, mainly because I wanted to do other things. I was interested in working with adults and in working in publishing, and I was also interested in doing a bit of farming. So I thought the prescript was too narrow in the school situation. So that's why I moved. However, I did go back to Trinity in the early 70s and did a master's in local history. And I did my thesis on the Clogher Valley in the 18th and 19th century. It was a social and economic history.
Why did you decide to go to Trinity?
Why to Trinity? Well, I liked the idea of going to Trinity. It appealed to me. I don't know really why I made that choice. There were still people from the north going to Trinity in those days. Students from OMA and other grammar schools would have gone to Trinity, but that number has reduced greatly because of the clearance system with the university entrance nowadays. I mean, in those days, at least three or four from my school would have gone to Trinity.
I see, yes.
But that has been reduced considerably now. I mean, there was a good strong trickle of northern people going to Trinity College in those days.
And you were brought up in the Church of Ireland tradition?
No, I was brought up a Presbyterian. I have a long heritage of Presbyterian worship. Several of my ancestors, I think about seven of them, were Presbyterian ministers over the years. But we became Church of Ireland in the late 1970s because of the increasing fundamentalism within the Presbyterian Church, which didn't sit easily with my own views. There was also a problem with the local minister who refused to baptise my son unless I would profess to be an evangelical Christian. I wasn't going to jump through hoops that I wasn't happy with. So we became Church of Ireland, and I've been a member of the Church of Ireland ever since.
I see. So, but most of your life is where we are right now in
yes,
Clogher.
Yes, I mean, I've spent nearly all of my life here, apart from a few years in Dublin when I was doing my primary degree, and also when I was doing research on my MLit. But apart from that, I've lived in this valley for most of my life, well over 60 years.
And your study and writing, you're a prolific writer, I can see all
well,
your books.
A lot of publications, yeah. A lot as editor, because I worked on a lot of projects, cross-border projects with different groups, cross-community projects. And I've done some publishing on my own steam in journals and in magazines and so on. I have a lot of publications over the year, probably 30 or more altogether. I also edited a local history review, the Spark magazine, which circulated through the border counties for nearly 20 years when I was the editor of it. It's still going strong, and another man brings it out now. And that's a very good vehicle for linking with groups north and south of the border.
So your experience and your knowledge of what happened in the last 30 years of the violence, 30 to 40 years now, along border towns and villages, you know, with the communities. So talk to me about those early days when the troubles first broke out?
Well, it was very difficult in the early years, particularly the early 70s, when there was a lot of tension and a lot of terrible atrocities on both sides. And I was still secretary of Clogher Historical Society in those years. And it, as you know, is per se a cross-border organisation, because half of the members live in the Republic and half live in Northern Ireland. So we were working essentially with two peoples, where a border was a big issue, and where roads were cratered, and where there were great difficulties in attending meetings north and south. But we kept going. We kept the society going. There were a number of very good people who were involved in it, and they sustained its work both in meetings and in the publishing of the journal, the Clogher Record. But it was a difficult time. It was difficult to get people to talk about their communities, to talk about their families. We eventually broke that down, and pardon me, and we were able to move on and to talk about it. Probably not just right away, but after a slight distance from the event, you know, we were able to talk about. I remember working with a group in Cunheen, which is between Five Mile Town and Brookborough, very much a border area, and there were atrocities there, and I found that difficult, particularly the time Sean South and O'Hanlon were killed as a result of the raid on Brookborough Barracks. It was difficult for the group to talk about that because it was right beside them. Similarly, in the 1920s, there had been an ambush of B specials near Cunheen Church. And again, it was very difficult. Some of them could remember back to the 1920s. So those were difficult areas because it was raw still. Even the 1920s incident was still raw with the community. Cunheen was a very good group in that they were well mixed, evenly mixed between Protestant and Catholic. They were marvellous people. They met for about 4 years altogether, once a fortnight, and one man in particular came in 4 miles on his tractor every fortnight to be part of the group, a small farmer. There was a difficulty in the group in that they both perceived a different spelling of the word Cunheen. The Protestants spelt it C-O-N-N-E-E-N, and the Catholics spelt it C-O-N-N-I-A-N. So when we came to their publication, I had to resolve how we would put the name on the front cover of the book. And the group met around Cunheen Cross. So the book was about Cunheen Cross, as you see there.
Yes.
The two spellings have been interlocked, and everybody was happy. At least I think they were all happy.
And so did you have any personal encounter with the Troubles yourself?
No, I didn't really.
Or your family?
Not really. Although where we live here, there was an army camp just about half a mile away across the valley there.
Yeah.
And that was attacked one night, and attacked by the IRA. And the bullets were flying. Some hit the wall of this house. That was about 1973 or 74. That was the closest I came to the gunfire of the Troubles. And there's a bit of a tractor that was blown up, still lying in a garden that I own over there, a piece of mangled metal. That was a later incident, maybe about 4 years later. So apart from those two incidents, which were attacks on military bases here, I didn't have any direct contact with the Troubles.
But your work as a social worker, as well as a historian, because you did work with groups in different projects, you were familiar with the violence.
The project I worked on between 1997 and 2003 was called the Border Counties History Collective. which was a group of about 21 or 22 history groups north and south of the border, in Fermanagh, in Cavan, Leitrim, and one or two in adjoining counties. And the whole thrust of it was to get those groups to come together, talking about local history.
This is 1990.
This is 1997. Through till about 2003. So that was valuable work in my view of bringing people together. In fact, some of those people had never crossed the border before, which I found staggering. I remember taking a group of from the southern groups to the public record office in Belfast, and one or two said to me they'd never been in Northern Ireland before. And similarly, I took a group of northern local history people to Killala for the reenactment of the French landing in 1998. And they said they'd never been across the border either. I mean, I was totally surprised that people had travelled so little. But it was largely because of their background and because of the ongoing troubles, certainly for younger people, the ongoing troubles.
And it was still raw in the 1990s after the Enniskillen bombing. So people were for...
Oh, yes, yes.
They were hurt, and badly hurt.
Well, that's true. A lot of them found it difficult to talk about it. I suppose some of the Catholic people in the groups probably found it difficult to talk to me because I was perceived to be a Northern prod. It took a long time before they could see that I had no agenda. My own politics were pretty liberal as a Protestant goes. I'd been to Trinity College. I was a reader of the Irish Times. I didn't belong to any of the loyal orders. I was a different sort of prod than they probably rubbed shoulders with most of the time they went out of their house. But eventually I got trust. But it took some time to gain the trust shall we say, nationalists or people who are from the Catholic community. And in the same way, some of the prods were suspicious of me because they thought I was too yellow, I suppose, or I hadn't enough backbone in their version of events. But eventually I was able to gain the trust of a lot of people through publishing their material and through dialogue and through organising lectures and events like what I told you about going to Belfast or going to Killala. But it was a slow process, winning the trust of these people. But very rewarding, having said that, you know.
This mistrust of their Catholic neighbours and vice versa was there. How do you get a community to live together with that kind of environment?
Well, I think it's a very slow process, you know, and it's making people aware of what the other side does and thinks is the big thing. And opening the door, for example, getting people to visit Catholic churches who probably had never been in a Catholic church, or vice versa, getting Catholics to visit a Protestant church. Mm-hmm. I think those have been important steps. For a long time, people didn't go to funerals of the other side, shall we say. Mm-hmm. But now that's much easier and happens. In this community, certainly, it happens all the time. And people have no problem now about going into a church that is alien to them, if you like.
Conflict was always there. It was in this county and
Oh, yes.
And also Fermanagh.
Conflict was always there and was rarely talked about. But then to get people talking about it was a way forward. And I think once they found they could discuss the 98 Rebellion, or they could discuss Robert Emmet or Catholic Emancipation or the Home Rule Crisis or even the Ulster Covenant, once people could talk about it, there was a great freedom, I think, arrived in the room. And to me, that was terribly rewarding. Once people could talk openly, about these seminal events in Irish history.
So as an independent historian and who deals with your area, because you did local and regional studies, you were saying, in doing that work, you must have a great understanding of the way people react around here.
Well, I have worked with local history groups all over South Ulster and much of North Connacht, and trying to give them the mechanics of local history and the sort of areas they might study, because they'll find in it a lot of common ground with their neighbour, despite what political label or religious affiliation they have. There is a great common ground in local history, no matter what part of the country we're dealing with, whether it be South Ulster or North Connacht or even North Leinster, because I've seen the fruits of their labours, I've seen their publications, and I've seen how enthusiastic they can be when discussing, things like the linen industry or corn milling or farming or transport. I mean, there's a lot of common ground there where you're not getting into interfaces, if you like, or difficult areas.
So did you uncover by any chance, if we look back in at the history of the North of Ireland in the last, say, 60, 70 years, that there was an imbalance, because if you were born into a Catholic family, you didn't get the opportunity to get a good job. People would say that. You also had a situation if you were wanted to buy a house, that there was objection to that locally. So that, do you agree with me?
Oh yes,
that?
I mean, I agree entirely with you. There was a vast amount of discrimination and sectarianism in the North of Ireland. And a lot of it on foot of the unionist executive in Stormont, you know, who just had a one-track mind for over 50 years. And, I mean, they're reaping the fruits of this now in that they didn't allow the Catholics to have a fair say, to get a job, to get a house. I mean, it is a very valid point you made. There has been vast discrimination over the years, practiced by the Stormont government, the unionist government in Stormont.
And you can see now why I suppose there was unrest. But from, do you think at the same time that there was a difficulty with the, say, with the Church of Ireland or with the Presbyterian or the Methodist populations, that they were keeping to themselves, that they didn't really want to mix with go to the same dance hall?
That's true. I mean, we had two societies, if you like, operating side by side, and we're quite happy to keep that double society going, that double community going. And it was only on rare occasions where the two would meld together or would come together, although it did happen. I mean, for example, in this community here, the Coronation Sports 1953 was embraced by the schools of all traditions, and the local people all took part. If you were to have another Coronation Sports today, it'd be entirely different. They wouldn't take part because they've been poisoned by Sinn Féin to a large extent, the Catholic community, against sharing, you know, in a sports day or a festival to celebrate a new British monarch. Mm-hmm. But I noticed that when I did my history of Clogher, how at each coronation it was a big day out for everyone.
And why did that tradition not continue?
Well, I think it was just the troubles, and I think the rise of Sinn Féin is largely to blame for that. There was a nationalist community who would have been quite happy, you know, to have met with their Protestant neighbours. So in many ways, I think Sinn Féin are to blame. I blame the Stormont government for, you know, keeping the lid on jobs and houses. But I also blame Sinn Féin for their attitude in trying to turn the nationalist people away from a normal interaction in society with their Protestant neighbours.
And in all the projects you worked on, which was the most successful and why was it the most successful?
Well, I enjoyed the project on workhouses of the Northwest, which was a study of workhouses, pardon me, in the border counties of Ulster, and it resulted in a publication. And the groups there were mixed. When I say mixed, I mean Protestant and Catholic. And I must say they got on well together. We came together several times to share the stories of the workhouse, the story of the local poor. And I mean, when we got down to that level, there was nobody worrying whether he was a Protestant or a Catholic pauper. It was just how the poor were treated and dealt with in a particular area. I found that very rewarding. But I found all my work rewarding, especially working with adults, because as time went on and we built confidences, they were happy to talk and keen to talk and quite relaxed to talk. The first couple of years of my work with the Border Counties Collective, there was always a strain in getting people to share their memories and to talk about their communities and to talk about how they were treated by their neighbours. But that definitely improved in the last two or three years.
What was that breakthrough? Why?
I think it was just people getting used to each other and realising, you know, that they could discuss the thing. There was no threat there. It was quite often we met in what would be called a neutral venue. At the start, sometimes, you know, we would meet in local halls, but each hall had a tag or a bit of baggage, or even the schools had a tag. So we met in the library or we met in a building that didn't have a tag, and people felt more at home when they were in a neutral venue. The community, for example, in Tempo met in an old farmhouse, and that was a neutral venue, although I suppose it could be perceived who owned the house was how it was tagged. But having a neutral venue was an important way forward.
If you go back in history, the plantation and Ulster Scots would be a very big part of that plantation. So they're always seen as Anglo, you know, that they don't belong. Do you think that sense of place is still not with some of the Protestant community that live here?
I wouldn't really agree with that at all. I still feel people here have a sense of place despite what their origins are in terms of whether they're planters or whether they're Gaelic families. And I found this in my campaign to save the townlands. People had an identity with their townland and a pride in their townlands. Even strong unionist families were quite happy to be, you know, Knockballyroney or Knocknacarney. They valued their Irish place name. So there was an identity there with place, which I think is still very strong, and which is an area I think that the peacemakers could develop, the sense of place that is in our townlands. Because no matter where we live, be it urban or rural, we all live in a townland. Mm-hmm. Towns are built in townlands. And I think there's an area there that could be developed.
But can you ever see where they can become more Irish than the Irish themselves? You know, because they still haven't.
Oh, I don't think so. Because I think we've agencies now working against that in many ways. Like the Ulster Scots, for example, are trying to create a kind of new identity for Protestants, if you like. A kind of fake identity that doesn't really exist. I mean, there is no Ulster Scots language. It's a dialect. This idea of trying to make Ulster Scots on a par with the Irish language is a nonsense, really. Mm-hmm. It won't work. In fact, they're both flogging dead horses, because there are more people speaking Portuguese in Ireland than they are speaking Irish, and there are more people speaking other languages than Ulster Scots.
And but staying with identity, how do you see yourself? Do you see yourself as Irish or Northern Irish, or
no? I have an Irish passport and always have. I consider myself Irish, and I'll be rooting for Ireland and Twickenham.
I see. Yes.
But I would have great hope for the future. There are an awful lot of people out there who have a great deal of common sense and who have a willingness to talk and get on with their neighbours. Mm-hmm. I'd have great optimism, really.
So, Jack, over the years, you've put together some major work. The work of in Fermanagh, now I'm talking about. Brookborough. Story in particular,
Brookborough would be perceived to be quite a Protestant town and community, and they had a twinning with Riverstown, County Sligo, which wasn't a nationalist community, but which was a well mixed community in Sligo, and they worked together as two history groups, running events and running exchanges and field days for about 3 years, and at the end of the day each produced a book about their community, and I edited both books, so I worked closely with the two communities.
And the contributors to those books,
they were mixed contributors. We had about 30 or 40 contributors to each volume. In the Brookborough case, both Bishops of Clogher contributed, Bishop Duffy and Bishop Jackson. That was a significant thing, apart from all the other. There are Orange men in there writing about their Orange lodges. There are folk writing about their GAA clubs. So, it's a well-balanced study, in a sense, although Brookborough would be perceived to be a Protestant community today.
And other areas in Fermanagh, like Ross Lane now, where a lot of the troubles, happened, would that be perceived as mostly Catholic?
Ross Lane would be mostly a nationalist town, I suppose, although they did have a history group which was mixed, although predominantly a Catholic membership. Lisnasgee was another group I worked with quite a bit. They're going over 25 years, Lisnasgee History Group, evenly mixed between Protestant and Catholic, and a group that got on very well together and did a lot of good work, and are still doing a lot of good work. There was a group in Florence Court, you mentioned there. There was one in Belcoo, one in Temple. The Temple group was particularly good because they pushed the barriers and brought in speakers, who had a very challenging area. Mary Hamilton, who was the secretary of the Temple group, was very good at recruiting speakers to come to Temple to speak in the old farmhouse, Jackson's old farmhouse, which again was important because it was a neutral venue. At one stage, there were about 16 groups in Fermanagh, history groups, not all going simultaneously, but all having a life of their own for a number of years.
And the trains, I see. Would that
you like this one?
I do indeed.
This was a group in Tyrone, all ex-railway men of all persuasions.
Yeah.
And their memories and their anecdotes are in this. And the greatest find was that an ex-railway man from Strabane had joined up with the UN troops and was seen reading Railway Days in Strabane on the border with Somalia.
Yes. My goodness.
So we pushed the boundaries a bit further. You see that there?
I do.
He's reading the first edition of Railway Days in Strabane.
You've done so much editing. Did you ever encounter any difficulty proofreading stuff?
Yeah, this book here, The Road to the Hills, some people objected to a particular photograph in here. I tried to balance this book out by having, there's B specials at Cunion, there's a B special funeral. There were one or two people objected to those photographs being in the book, and yet it was part of the history of that community. I tried to be as even-handed as I could in the choice of photographs, these photographs of the specials now got up the noses of some people. And only a minority, but still, it was drawn to my attention that I shouldn't have included those in the book.
So you have to be so careful.
You have to be so careful. Yeah. You have to be very even-handed. When I did my own book on Clocher, this is recently, this is only about 2 years ago, I mean, I was very keen that I should treat it as even-handedly as possible, and almost went down to counting the number of photographs that could be perceived to be of one side or another, just to make sure I was giving a balanced view. So many community histories are out of kilter, you know, and they're one-sided, or they show a bias.
Yeah.
But I was keen that my book would be... I'll just show you it briefly. I mean, even what to put on the cover. So I put the hill fort on the cover, which I thought was neutral. I could have put a photograph of the cathedral, which is probably the most iconic building in Clocher. But again, I thought I'd just put the hill fort on it.
Will a time ever come, Jack, when you don't even have to think about that, whether you're going to hurt somebody's feelings?
Hopefully it will. I mean, even the photographs of the schools, I had to try and make sure I balanced them with the same number of photographs of each school, the same number of photographs of each church. And even writing about organisations, I mean, there were much more, many more Protestant organisations in the community than there were Catholic. So I had to go out of my way to make sure I got every organisation that reflected the community, like St. Vincent de Paul, you see, which is very much a minority thing in this area, or the there are one or two other. I mean, I put in a bit about traditional music, because we did a lot in about proddy bands, and again, I thought it's important to, you know, there's a nationalist band. It was very hard to get that photograph, but I was determined to use it.
Which one is that?
This is a nationalist band, a pipe band, in this community. I mean, there are lots of photographs of orange bands, but I was keen to be even-handed, and even went to a lot of trouble to identify these people, because a lot of people had forgotten who they were. So it's a bit of a minefield, you know, local history publishing, if you want to be perceived to be neutral.
Mm-hmm. And this is the way it's going to be for a while, you feel. But great progress has been made.
A lot of progress has been made, yes, definitely.
Have you any pet projects, or was there any particular one that stood out as being very special to you?
Well, I was always keen that the Townland campaign would have a legacy, and that people would value, you know, their place and their townland. And Fermanagh was the last of the six Ulster counties to use townlands as the only line of address. They've now caved in, and they now have the post office address plus the townland. Mm-hmm. And of course, the townland comes second in that line of address. The post office address comes first. But we fought a long rearguard action to save the townlands, both in Tyrone here and in Fermanagh.
And I know you, during the interview, you spoke about this, but within the townland, you were saying that you have a very, that it holds a community. This is what it's all about,
yes,
isn't
yes.
it?
Yes, I think so. I mean, people identify with their townland, and there is a sense of community there. Not so much maybe nowadays, because everybody's got a motor car now and can travel further afield, but when you were walking or when you were on a bicycle, the townland was a little world of its own.
And the parish, would that not, you know, within the parish is the town's land?
The parish is an important unit still, and the parish has been kept alive largely by the GAA, who have promoted the parish, you know, in the terms of league structures. But strangely enough, the people who are often keeping the townland alive are the Orange Order. Because if you look at the names on some of the orange banners, they proclaim the townland where the little lodge sits, Tamnificarbon, Glenageara, Rochan, Lislane. These are all townlands. Rochan LOL, Lislane LOL, Liskenny LOL. So here you have the orange side, if you like, promoting the Gaelic place name because it's the rural location where their little hall was situated. And and at the parish level then, the GAA are promoting the use of the parish name. I always find that rather interesting. I think it's important that people can embrace each other's culture and appreciate each other's culture. And I think that's a growing thing. People are quite happy now to identify with, you know, a particular event, you know, on a particular day. I mean, the 12th of July is very much Orangeman's Day. But years ago in this community, a lot of people came out to watch the bands and view the bands, regardless of where they came from. So I think things like that are welcome. I just can't think of another example on the other side of the coin, if you like.
St. Patrick's Day.
Well, St. Patrick's Day has been sanitised now to some extent. Yeah, I suppose St. Patrick's Day has, yes.
Jack Johnson, thank you. Thank you very much indeed.